Welcome to the OIS Podcast, where you get candid conversations with the leaders and drivers of ophthalmic innovation. And now, here's our host, Tom Salemi.
And welcome back to the OIS Podcast. I'm Tom Salemi, and I'm pleased to be joined by Dan Myers. Dan is the co-founder of Alimera Sciences and has served as the president and CEO since 2003. Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Tom.
You presented well at this year's OIS in Chicago. You looked quite relaxed up there, and I can understand why, having just recently secured FDA approval for Iluvien as a treatment for DME. It was a huge win for the company. I mean, you had to overcome three early negative decisions from the FDA, and most recently last year, I know the FDA initially had tried to steer you back toward an advisory committee meeting. I think that you were able to reverse that request, but not to make light of a difficult situation, but you know, this, you may hold a record of sorts of having to overcome that many negative outcomes from the FDA. Can you think back to last October when you received word, the third bit of bad news, and how did you respond to that? How do you recover from news like that?
Sure. Well, obviously that's a record I don't want to try to hold again or break. I'll let some other CEO break that one in due time. So it's not one I want to repeat. But I do think, though, it is a, first of all, how do we recover? How do we, you know, endure during that period? I think it's a testimony to the Alimera team and their belief in Iluvien, and you know, kind of the culture of persistence that I hope we can say we've fostered here at Alimera in facing difficult circumstances, because that was a very tough road, to be sure. But you know, one thing, Tom, I'm really very proud of is in that period of time, which from the real devastating CRL, which was November 11th of 2011, where I think everyone in the industry as well as we thought we would get approval. During that time till the approval on September 26 of this past year, in the regulatory and clinical group, we did not lose one employee. And I really took heart in seeing those people believing in the data, believing in the product, and just basically saying we're going to find a path forward. When I think, to answer your question, when I think specifically about the CRL in October, the one that we received in 13, it was an unusual CRL. I think it confused a lot of people. I think inside that CRL, if you read it in depth, it gave us some hope when you say, how do you kind of recover? If you recall, it was a CRL, but it recommended, as you noted in your earlier comments, an advisory committee meeting, which was going to take place in the following January. It would have been January of this past year, 14. So we felt like the FDA, while we are still not in agreement on approvability, obviously, with the FDA at that point, we thought they were signaling that they're willing to at least hear from the retinal specialists and patient advocacy groups, patients perhaps themselves, and that was a possibility that, you know, Iluvien could get approved for the treatment of DME in the U.S. by the fact that they were willing to go to the AdCom. And that gave us some hope, because we always felt that the retinal community saw value in Iluvien, and if the opportunity was there for us to present their view, it might have an impact on the FDA's view of DME and the role of Iluvien in the treatment of DME. So actually, that was why we continued to persevere through the entire process. In my 30-plus years of ophthalmic experience, I'd never had the kind of encouragement that we received from the retinal community about, you know, persisting and keeping the faith and trying to get Iluvien approved. Now, you have to remember also, during that time, I guess another answer to how we kept pressing on is we were getting approvals in Europe. We had 7 countries approved in Europe from the time we got the CRL in 11 to the time we got approval. So we had some hope that with time, maybe that the FDA could come to see the data in the same way that some of the EU regulatory bodies had seen it as well.
What is it's a common theme in med tech and in biotech, you know, what is approved in Europe may face difficulties in the U.S. You seem to be a poster child of that, since you have had success in Europe and you until recently had some difficulties here. What do you see as the differences? Is it more complicated than people understand? Is it really a case by case thing, or is there just generally an easier pathway in Europe than in the U.S.?
Well, I think, I'm not sure I'd say it's an easier pathway, because it's really a little bit of fool's gold when you think about the process, because you can get perhaps a marketing authorization more quickly in Europe than you can perhaps in the FDA, and certainly that was the case in our experience. But of course, that doesn't say at that point that the government's going to reimburse, and so you're only halfway home at that point. And so you kind of have to choose your poison, I guess. You might have more interactive process from the clinical side with the Europeans than I think sometimes we see with the FDA. So I guess one of the differences I would say is it's a little more interactive when you're dealing with the EU authorities than perhaps the FDA. The FDA's process is a little more formal, which means you've got to request meetings, and you know that just takes time. I mean, a lot of people still marvel that we didn't do any other additional clinical trials, and yet it still took us 3 years to get to the approval, whereas in the EU, I think those interactions are more spontaneous, mm-hmm. and so you have things move quicker. Now, having said that, of course, once you get approval or marketing authorization, now you still have to work through those reimbursement hurdles, whereas in the U.S., with an FDA approval, then you're certainly not as concerned about getting the payers on board. So I don't know. It's probably six one, half dozen the other, but mm-hmm. I think on the front end, it's certainly easier to work through some of the EU processes than it would be with the FDA.
Going back to your management of the company during these reviews, and how you maintained that you stated that you've kept all of your employees, which is great. How do you, as a manager, keep people believing and keep people engaged, and most importantly, keep people with your company so you can keep moving forward at a good clip?
Right. I think part of it is the product we were dealing with here and the disease of DME. I mean, if you've got a topical drop that's treating allergy, and you know you've got a setback, and you know the data may be for some reason not satisfactory to the FDA, that doesn't have kind of the personal attachment I think a lot of our personnel in the clinical and regulatory side had in working with the investigators on these trials. And again, as I said earlier, remembering that we also had a proven EU, so a lot of the U.S. employees were doing work over there, and they were seeing patients get implanted with Iluvien. They were seeing patients' vision getting better. So, you know, there's a much more of an emotional attachment, I think, with a product like Iluvien, where you're actually treating potential blindness versus other ophthalmic conditions where you may not have quite that same sense of connection with the patient. And as I said earlier, also, I think all the employees we had that were working with the retinal community always found a lot of encouragement there. And then finally, I just think we hire people with a lot of tenacity. We just basically say never, never, never quit. And I'm very proud of that aspect of our company.
And the folks who are less passionate about those products are public investors, and you're a publicly traded company. What was the task like of managing their expectations?
I would say that was a bit harder. seriously, I think the fact that we did have such rapid validation of that same data package in Europe really was a win for us. Mm-hmm. You know, when we got the CRL in November of 2011, clearly, you know, our management team, my credibility was a bit on the line in that, you know, we'd been there twice now and gotten rejected. And so I think it's a fair question for shareholders and potential investors to ask, you know, do these guys know what they're doing? Fortunately, just 2 months later, we get approval for seven countries in the EU, which, of course, we had to, you know, get through reimbursement hurdles with all of them. But I think at that point, there was then, again, a sense of, well, maybe this is just an honest disagreement with FDA that could be worked through. And so we were finding people giving us a little more of a runway to say, well, let's see if they can come through on the next opportunity. And we were successful in 2012 of raising $40 million in a convert deal, that a preferred deal, that did finance our launch in Europe. So at the end of the day, I guess some people say, well, even if you don't get approval in the U.S., which we always hope we would, that this was a viable model and we could be profitable just in the EU. And so I think that kept a lot of people's hopes alive that we were a viable investment opportunity.
Let's talk a little bit about moving forward and about your opportunities in DME. What do you see as the limitations of existing treatments like steroids and anti-VEGF that create an opening for Iluvien?
Sure. I think the opportunity in the U.S. is significant. I'm very pleased with the labeled indication we got in the U.S. I don't, many of your listeners may not be aware, but we have a little more restriction in the EU countries for chronic DME and for patients who have been insufficiently responsive to previous treatment. In the U.S., I couldn't be more pleased with the label here because we don't have any of those restrictions. So I think the opportunity in the U.S. is very good. I mean, clearly our label allows for the retinal specialist to consider Iluvien for all patients that they believe would benefit from a multi-year therapy. So right away, I think the FDA, once we did get to agreement, was very practical in the label. There is a piece of the indication that talks about an appropriate course of steroid where the patient has not had a rise and a clinical significant rise in intraocular pressure. And I think there again, the way that was written leaves it very much to the discretion of the retinal specialist to determine what that course of steroid therapy would be and what in fact is a clinical significant rise in IOP. So I think at the end of the day, this gives the retinal physician a lot of latitude to use Iluvien where they think most appropriate, and to take the issue of managing IOP for in most part off the table. I think it should we keep in mind that 62% of patients in the FAME trial had no elevated intraocular pressure, and that a large majority of those who did have IOP rise were managed with eye drops. So I guess from a corporate standpoint, we probably couldn't ask for a better opportunity to give the physician the chance to make the decisions on where Iluvien is appropriate and where it is not. And that part of the work with the FDA and the outcome, I was very pleased with. As far as where all these kind of fit together, anti-VEGF and steroids, and where we're going to come out in the next year to 18 months as I think we learn more about DME and how that'll play, I think that's going to be fascinating, because I think we've all learned a lot in the last few years about DME and the role of anti-VEGFs and steroids that perhaps we didn't know when we started the FAME trial. I think there's a good amount of independent clinical data, such as the DRC or NET protocol eye trial, where, and with our physician experiences, where we would suggest that, perhaps as much as 40 to 50% of DME patients are not going to adequately respond to anti-VEGF therapy. And, you could argue, why is that? I think we're going to debate that over the coming months and years, that is it a multifactorial aspect of DME that you don't see in wet AMD? Multiple cytokines are in play here. Steroids, of course, have a broader application of those than perhaps the anti-VEGF therapy. I think we know that the administration in real life of the anti-VEGF compounds with DME patients is not as frequent as we saw in some of the clinical trials, and that certainly speaks to why we might not see some of the responses and the clinical efficacy that we would like to see in some DME patients. But I think it's all going to be sorted out, and doctors will decide where steroids fit. But I think we definitely can say with confidence that steroids will have a role in treating DME patients. I think once a doctor makes a decision that steroids are appropriate for a patient, then you go into another level of discussion about whether it would be a steroid is more appropriate to for a short-acting steroid that results in more of a pulse therapy, or a more consistent low-dose long-term treatment like Iluvien. I'm sure your listeners would know where we come out on that at Alamira in that discussion, but as I said many times, if you weren't concerned about the management of IOP, and that's certainly something that doctors would need to get through as we look at our labeling of a course of steroid. If you weren't concerned about, though, that, then we believe a long-term low-dose steroid is an optimal way to treat a long-term persistent disease like DME, and we look forward to that debate as we move into launching the product first part of next year.
The financial side of the equation is always a very important part and increasingly important. What sort of response are you getting from payers? What has that process been like?
We've done several surveys and interviews. We had done quite a bit, by the way, back kind of our first pass when we thought an approval was coming back in 11. So some of that applicable, some of it was not. So we've redone some of those surveys. We've had interviews with payers. And right now we're encouraged by the response, but we intend to do more of those between now and the official launch. I think the acceptance of our pricing has been well-received for several reasons. First of all, even though we think in the ophthalmic marketplace that DME is a large opportunity, and certainly it is, but when you put it in the context of a classic normal size managed care plan, the cost of DME is less than typically 1% of a managed care's plan's total budget for the year. So they've been pretty clear to us that they're not likely to try to manage a cost center that small unless the price is unreasonable, which would bring to the second point of the cost of Iluvien versus other therapies over a three-year period where you're going to see multi-year therapy. And if you look at the current approved products out there, and I'm roughly estimating here, Tom, but anywhere from $10,000 to probably $30,000 the cost of a therapy for treating DME over 3 years. We're going to price, as I've said publicly a couple of times, Illuvien between $8,000 and $9,000. We're going to narrow that down shortly to an exact price, but we'll be between $8,000 and $9,000. And many of the plans then will find us actually more cost-effective in treating the patient than what's currently available therapy. So we think that'll be attractive. I've actually had, in light of those economics, I've been asked before if we, quote, didn't leave money on the table, that Illuvien might actually be priced too low, and I guess one could make the argument for that. But one of the things we do need to consider when you're thinking about these payers, they do have budgets to meet as well, and although the cost over 3 years might be more attractive for Illuvien in total, it is a fact that you're going to have to pay for Illuvien up front. So even though the cost effectiveness is very strong over 3 years, the budget impact on a payer in year one is something we took into account. So when we set that pricing, that was one of the issues we had, of just taking into account that the payer will, in fact, be paying for the drug in the first year.
Great. And final question: what lies ahead for either Illuvien or for the rest of your pipeline? Any news expected in that front, or what challenges are facing you?
Sure. Well, we, as you can imagine and suspect, we were quite frugal in our spending as we were in that period of time over the last 3 years, where we were waiting FDA approval, and we were really funneling the great amount of our capital into the European commercial opportunity. So we had either frozen or delayed any additional work on expanding Illuvien indications, which we think there could be some applications, and we'll reconsider and restart that in our 2015 budget. As I said, most of our spending really moved around commercial expansion and geographic expansion. That, I guess if I could say that, that was our pipeline for the last 3 years. And we're excited about Europe, by the way. We've got now over 1,000 patients implanted in Europe. The uptake in Germany has been a little slower than we would have liked because of the some of the reimbursement issues. The UK we're very pleased with, and we're seeing that patients are definitely benefiting from Illuvien, and the uptake in doctor responses has been good. So, you know, we will look at doing other things as far as expanding indications around Illuvien, but at this point we have nothing that we would want to talk about publicly in our pipeline.
Terrific. Well, we wish you the best of luck with Illuvien, and appreciate your joining us on the podcast.
Great. Thanks, Tom.
Have a great day. Thanks for listening to this OIS podcast. Next week, we'll continue our conversations with ophthalmology's leaders. Please listen in.
OIS is now accepting applications for presenting companies. Share your technology and clinical data with over 800 industry executives, investors, and key opinion leading ophthalmologists. To be considered for the Ophthalmology Innovation Showcase, apply online at www.ois.net/application.